Welcome to a podcast of The Mike Novak Show. You can listen to Mike live Sunday mornings from 9 to 11 Central on Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM. Live from the beautiful Showcase Studios on South Pulaski Road, just across the street from the 53A bus stop and in between Paco's Tacos and Zaka Tacos, it's The Mike Novak Show, Chicago's only locally broadcast green, gardening, and environment program. Heard every Sunday right here on Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM.
Good planets are hard to find. Temperate zones and tropic climes. True currents and thriving seas. Wind blowing through breathing trees. Strong ozone and safe sunshine. Well, good planets are hard to find. Good planets are in the main.
This hour of The Mike Novak Show is brought to you by The Care of Trees, our business's people and their love for trees. And by Back to Nature Compost. Life doesn't start with the seed, it starts with the soil. He's green, so don't make him angry. You wouldn't like him when he's angry. Here he is, Mike Novak. And they pay me for this, folks. Okay.
Not here today. Heather, where is Mike? He's at that Trappist monastery in North Dakota.
I think so.
He's had a retreat where he has to keep total silence for 48 hours. Am I right about that?
I don't think it's possible for Mike to keep silence for more than 48 minutes, let alone 48 hours.
So we'll see him back here in about 5 minutes.
I'm wondering if the phone will ring.
I'm wondering if he can
stay away, unless he's really, I mean, he's far away, no Wi-Fi connection, you know, like you said, in some sort of like hut or cave.
Yeah.
You know, cut himself off from the outside world. Went off and it's a nature thing. He went to reconnect.
He went to reconnect.
Yes.
Actually, folks, he's down in St. Louis giving a speech to the National Garden Clubs. So I'm sitting in for him today on the Mike Novak Show. I'm Beth Botts. I'm a writer. I'm a gardener. I'm a blogger at growinginchicago.com. And today we have a show that's pretty heavy on gardening. We're going to be talking to Glenda Daniel from Open Lands about the 20th anniversary of the Tree Keepers Program and about caring for trees. We have Brianne Heath of Growing Home here in the studio with us to talk about compost and leaves and all that good earthy stuff. And then we're going to have Rick DeMaio with the weather for gardeners. And then we're going to have Ed Lyon, director of the Allen Centennial Gardens up there at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. He's going to be talking specifically about bulbs, which it soon will be time to plant. And, of course, we will be happy to take your gardening questions. The call-in number for questions is 773-838-WCPT. That's 773-838-9278. And if we don't know the answer to your question, we'll make something up.
I like it. It's usually how it's done, right?
That's usually how it's done.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm a master gardener. Brianne is here. We're going
to
have all these other garden
experts. Here, you can pull it closer to you. There you go. Sorry.
And if you are on Twitter, Mike's feed is at Mike Now. My feed is at Chicago Gardener. We will try to keep up with both streams if it's within our technological capability. But
it's really going to test my multitasking today. That's the one thing I can say. It's nice being in the chair.
Yeah,
it's like Mike, I'm in your chair. Ha 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 ha. And but yeah, what's he always complaining about? This is easy.
Who I am, I'm a writer. I blog at growinginchicago.com, and you'll find a lot of the links to things we'll mention on today's story at my blog at growinginchicago.com. I'm also a writer. I have a cover story about Japanese maples in Organic Gardening magazine this issue. I write for the Tribune. I had recent stories about bulbs and lawn care. I'm also a senior editor at Chicagoland Gardening. And in the October issue, I have stories about using leaves for mulch and compost, garlic propagating, and an inspirational garden in LaGrange. So you should definitely pick up that issue.
I would say so.
No,
the leaves are huge because they're already turning red. It just turned fall Friday, and they're already changing.
Already changing.
Mm-hmm.
And I really noticed, you're right,
yeah.
It was Friday. I really noticed that it all of a sudden happened.
Yeah, it was just like, oh, it's fall. It starts.
Well,
love it. I hate it when they do fall. I hate seeing naked trees, even though I understand the natural, progression of them. But mm-hmm. It's like, I love my leaves.
Yes.
I like seeing them, so it just means it's going to get cold, which I don't like either.
Well, but it happens every year.
I know. And it's so beautiful. It's like when they're all golden and red and, oh.
Yeah. If we get a good, I think the formula for that is you have to have sunny days and chilly nights for the best color. So we'll see if we are able.
We'll have to ask Rick.
We'll have to ask Rick.
Yeah, that sounds good.
If we
like
can,
that. I like it when it's warm in the day and you can put that sweatshirt on at night and sit around the campfire. That's wonderful. That's perfect weather if you ask me.
Yeah. So, folks, don't forget, you can call in with questions at 773-838-WCPT. That's 773-838-9278. And do we have Glenda Daniel on?
No, I have to get her on the line yet.
You have to let her go.
Sorry.
All right. Okay.
Okay, that's what Mike's talking about.
That's what Mike's talking about.
No, I'm sorry. I thought we were going with our live guest first, so that was my misunderstanding.
Yeah.
Haha, Mike's laughing. I know.
Mike's laughing.
Here, you guys take it over, and I will get Glenda for you.
Well, we're just going to go ahead and start talking about compost, and when we get hold of Glenda Daniel, we'll start talking about trees. So, Brianne Heath, you're a trainer with Growing Home. Tell us a little bit about Growing Home, what Growing Home does.
Horticulture, farming, things like that. And then the idea is that after they graduate from that program, they not only have a lot of technical skills,
but also skills for moving on to employment afterward.
And you are a trainer, and you also have responsibility for the Tsukasa Worker Garden, is that right?
Right, yeah. It's Tsukasa Catholic Worker, located at 51st and Laughlin. And we have two organic beds there, as well as some of our training gardens for the horticulture and landscaping segments.
And more to the point of today's program, you have how many compost bins?
We have six bins that total almost 20 cubic yards. And the reason we have so much compost is because we have separate compost for our organic certification. So that's just waste from our garden. But then we also compost waste from the house, which also operates a soup kitchen. So lots of household scraps with that one.
Okay. And so they behave differently, right?
They do. They do.
And how do they behave differently if you just got one bin that you're putting stuff from the garden in, and you've got one bin that you're putting food waste in? How are those two compost bins going to behave differently?
Well, especially around this time of year, you can see a lot of difference just visually. So, for example, with the bin that has more of the household scraps, say things like fruit, maybe eggshells, vegetable trimmings, we see a lot of yellow jackets around that unless it's properly covered.
Okay.
And then with the yard waste, we don't see any of that because, there's no sugars to really attract things like the yellow jackets.
Okay. The yellow jackets are these wasps that a lot of people mistake for bees. And they're attracted to sugars and they're attracted to moisture. Am I right?
Right.
And so, a lot of people freak out because they get a little bit of insect action around their compost pile. But usually that's not a problem, right?
Right, right. And especially if you're just composting yard waste or garden waste, you don't really see that at all.
I got Glenda for you.
Okay. All right. We're going to go. We're going to pick up the compost discussion a little bit later on. But right now we have Glenda Daniel from Open Lands on the phone. Glenda, you there? Glenda?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
Glenda is Associate Director of Open Lands, And she's here to talk to us about the 20th anniversary of the Tree Keepers Program. You're having a big celebration today, aren't you, Glenda?
We are. This afternoon, we're going to gather at the Columbus Park Refectory on West Jackson Boulevard with as many tree keepers as we can get there from all the classes of trained tree keepers from the past 20 years. We have people even from the first class and a lot of the more recent people.
I personally, this is a huge honking conflict of interest here, folks. I happen to be tree keeper number 973. One is known when one is a tree keeper by one's number. And if one is stopped by the tree police for pruning trees in the public way, one responds with name, rank, and serial number. Mine is 973.
Mine is 285.
You are a pretty early tree keeper.
It's interesting that when tree keepers are all activists, and so when tree keepers are at some kind of community meeting for any subject, they will always introduce themselves as their name and their tree keeper number. It's really interesting.
Yes. Well, that's because that's what tree keeper Jim DeHorn tells us to do.
That's right.
And we do everything that tree keeper Jim DeHorn tells us to do.
He's a benevolent dictator.
He is. He is. He's probably not listening in today because he disdains all technology.
Especially email.
Does he do email now? I thought he had to have his emails printed out to be read to him.
He does. He doesn't do email. No.
Oh, Jim. And so how did Tree Keepers get started?
Well, it got started because there were... The urban forestry budget had been cut by a previous mayor, and so there were no new trees being planted, and then we started a program to just plant, program called Neighborwoods, to plant some trees just to make the point, and then Mayor Daley got elected, and they ramped up the urban forestry budget again and started planting trees. So we decided to found tree keepers to maintain the trees on public land. So tree keepers mulch, prune, water, keep an eye on trees on public parkways, commercial streets, and in city parks. And now we're about to start. The city budget is in trouble again, even though they want to support trees. But Open Lands is going to start planting a lot more trees again now, I think.
And if you're interested in becoming a tree keeper, you can check out the program at openlands.com.
.org.
I'm sorry? Openlands.org.
Right.
I'm going to take a little break from trees for a minute here. We have a caller on the line, Richard from Round Lake. Wanting to know, when do you divide and transfer hostas? Richard, you there?
Yes, I'm here.
So you have a lot of hostas?
Oh, I have many.
You have many hostas. I'm with you.
Many, and I want to transplant some of them, and I don't know exactly when to do it.
Well, listen, I have many, many, many hostas in my yard because my yard is almost entirely shade. And I was out there yesterday digging up hostas and dividing hostas. Hostas are pretty tough in my experience, and this is actually a really good time of year to be dividing perennials because there's still several weeks of warm soil before the soil freezes, so the transplanted plants will have a good chance to establish their root systems before the ground freezes. So just make sure that you, wherever you plant them, that you water them well and keep them watered. I personally, yesterday, I gave away 27 hostas, most of them to my next-door neighbor. And there comes a point at which you sort of have to sneak the hostas into your next-door neighbor's yard because they won't take anymore. So,
that's right. Hostas, when you buy one, if you buy the first one from a nursery or from a garden store, they're kind of expensive, but then they just won't quit, so you can just keep dividing them forever. Years ago, we started a great perennial divide with garden clubs to give away plants, and they always had a lot of hostas. But what do you think, Beth, about certainly you can do them now, but in the spring they're smaller.
In the spring they're smaller, but you can do it then. The only time I really wouldn't do it would be, you know, like in August when it's 110 degrees
right,
or whatever.
Middle of the summer.
You want it to be reasonably cool so that the soil doesn't dry out instantly.
I see. Could I ask one question?
Sure.
When I go to transplant them now, should I cut the old leaves off or should I leave them on?
Nah, just
and just let them wither by themselves?
That's the thing to do. Just let them, you know, because the plant will still be photosynthesizing a little bit for a while. And it's starting to go dormant, but in the meantime, it's still got a little bit of photosynthesis action going on. And if you cut the leaves off, you'll just stress it that much more.
Oh, okay.
So anyway.
Great. That's a great answer.
Okay.
If it
well, thanks for
today,
calling,
Rick.
That's
where I'm going to be, transplanting.
Good. Thanks for calling, Richard.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So, Glenda?
Yes.
So, tell us a little bit about the oak propagation project of Tree Keepers.
Well, there is a West Suburban chapter of Tree Keepers that's centered in Oak Park. And with the cooperation of Morton Arboretum, Tree Keepers in Oak Park and other in River Forest out there went and gathered acorns from the historic oaks in Oak Park, and there are many of those, and they grew them in greenhouses, in the greenhouse at Morton Arboretum, and now they're replanting them, and they're putting them up for adoption to people who will plant trees and in Oak Park and elsewhere, right, to get some new oaks going to that have a historic connection.
So in order to adopt an oak, you have to have a certain kind of a site, don't you?
You do. You need to have plenty of room to grow. You need plenty of soil around it. Don't plant it in a tree pit or anything like that. Of course, sandy loam is kind of the best, but Julie Samuels on our staff and Catherine Jonas, who is a tree keeper out in Oak Park, will be willing to help people look at their sites, and I think there are some public lands that you can plant them on too.
You have to have a fair amount of space for an oak, right?
Well, the more space the more space you have for any tree, the better, because they need to spread their roots. They need to spread their roots near the surface to get oxygen, and oaks are used to growing in savannas and prairies, and there's a lot of sunlight around, and there's a lot of open space between the trees.
So if you wouldn't be wise to shoehorn this tree into a little corner of your urban yard or underneath your power line?
Definitely not. Height is another issue, of course. You should never plant anything other than an ornamental tree that doesn't get very tall under a power line, or preferably don't plant anything except perennials under a power line, or shrubs.
Short things.
Yes.
Short things. We have a caller calling in with a tree question.
Okay.
We have Feeney. Are you there, Feeney?
Yes, speaking.
Hi there.
Hello there.
What's your tree question?
I got they're 9 feet high. I wanted to trim the top of them, take a bit off the top of them, you know.
What kind of tree is it?
Nigro.
Glenda?
I'm not
Nigro.
Hearing the
N-I-G-R-O,
question.
N-I-G-R-O, Nigro tree.
Cut the top off a tree, and what was
the family
kind of tree?
The Arboretti.
A nigril tree, I believe.
A nigril?
Yeah, right.
Are we familiar with that, Glenda?
No.
I'm not. But there's a general principle about pruning trees on the top.
Right. You don't want to top trees ever, because that will just create, if you just trim the top of it like you would when you're trimming a hedge, a shrub, you'll just create a bunch of new witch's brooms, we call them, a bunch of new little stems that will come off all sides of where you cut it. So you want to go down to the side of the tree and you cut, you find a new leader if you want the tree to, you find a new single leader, a branch that's going straight up, and then you cut from the side the branches down to what's called the branch collar. It's a at the base of where one branch joins another one, it's sort of a swollen area. Just outside that, you cut. So you carefully prune to keep your tree from getting taller, but you never top it, no matter what kind of tree it is.
Because that's going to make it look really deformed.
Yes.
And weird looking.
Definitely.
So you don't trim the top of them, right?
Right. Don't trim the top.
Oh, okay. Just let them grow.
The better thing to do is to just make sure that you get a tree in the first place that's not going to get bigger than what you want it, than the space you have for a tree.
But these grow 10 feet high. They grow 10 feet high.
Okay.
Well,
and sometimes I once bought a dwarf cherry that turned out to get a lot taller than it was supposed to.
Yes.
But you always do want to ask, you know, yes, and it looks like you have, ask how tall will this tree be at maturity?
Yes.
Something that's cute now is going to get a lot taller.
Yes. Right.
And you need to be pruning it every year, you know, look and thin it and make sure, work at it all the time instead of just once.
They grow very fast. They grow very fast, yes.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah.
I planted them 3 years ago. They were 5 feet high, and now they're 9 feet.
Yeah.
And they may keep growing for a while.
All along the fence, they're great privacy.
Uh-huh.
Okay, well,
I like
thanks
privacy.
A lot.
Thank you.
Brianne, what have you got to say?
I was just going to ask, Glenda, I think, couldn't you do something to stunt the growth of the roots? So, like, maybe by trimming back the roots, then the tree has to put its energy into that new root growth, and then it would actually slow down the top growth?
I've never heard that. Have you ever heard of that, Glenda?
You know, I could not hear that question at all. I heard a distant, small voice.
Oh, that's my voice.
Brianne was suggesting that it might be possible to cut off some of the roots to stunt the growth of the tree.
Oh, I wouldn't touch the roots. No, they look too nice to touch them.
Yeah.
I think not.
They're green all the year round, you know?
Yeah.
Right.
They look nice and great privacy.
Okay, great.
And I'm big on the compost. I use the compost every year on the garden.
Excellent, excellent. And way to go.
You're our kind of listener, Feeney.
I'm the greenest lawn in the neighborhood.
Good for you, Feeney.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks much for calling in. This is the Mike Novak Show on 8:20 a.m. And I'm sitting in for Mike Novak. I'm Beth Botts. And if you want to call in to ask a garden question, the telephone number is 773-838-WCPT. That's 773-838-9278. Glenda, tell us again where the tree keepers, I have the tree keepers meeting celebration, birthday celebration, 20th birthday celebration, reunion here today at 2 p.m. at the Columbus Park Refectory, 5701 West Jackson Boulevard. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And the admission cost is
$20? $20 to reflect the 20 years of Tree Keepers.
To reflect the 20 years of Tree Keepers. And if you just want to soak up that good tree vibe this afternoon, including the presence of all these deeply wise tree ent people, you'll be in Columbus Park, which is a great park. It was designed by Jens Jensen, the great landscape architect. So it's a really cool place to spend a Sunday afternoon. Glenda, let's talk a little bit about mulch. We have we're kind of into soil and mulch today, so talk a little bit about mulch and trees.
Well, the best kind of mulch for a tree is woody mulch, so wood chips, finely ground as possible, and you want to put them around the tree, you know. Pile it a couple of feet high, and then 3 feet out or so. I mean, ideally, you could put it all the way out, you know, to the drip line or farther, but mainly you want to keep a mulch away from the base of the tree, so hollow out a little donut space around the trunk so that you don't so you don't build up moisture and let fungus grow around the trunk. And mulch keeps the soil moist under the tree, and also prevents what we call lawnmower blight. If people are mowing their lawn and they bump into the tree a number of times, eventually on all sides, that will in effect girdle the tree and kill the cambium layer that lets the water nutrients travel up and down. So you don't want to, that's another reason to have mulch.
Hey, you said a couple of feet high. You don't really want mulch a couple of feet deep over the roots of a tree, do you? You just want a couple of inches, right?
Right, inches, I meant.
Inches.
Oh, yes, good, Beth. Inches. that would be awful. Yes,
yeah, yeah. Because you do see, you actually do see trees where people have piled the mulch a foot deep or even more than that, and they piled it right up against the trunk like it looks like a volcano.
Right.
And that's a bad thing, right?
That is absolutely the worst thing you can do. Well, the only worst thing is to pile soil up around the trunk. And a lot of people do that, too, thinking that the tree is like a light pole. You can just put soil around it and then plant flowers around it and then put a little, you know, rocks or brick around that and have a little garden. But you could have some perennials in your parkway, say, or your lawn, but keep it away from the base of the tree and make sure you don't pile soil up around the tree. And sometimes even so-called professional landscape firms will pile soil around the tree because they don't want to, after they've dug the hole to plant a tree, they don't want to have to haul the soil away and pay the tipping fee. So they also will pile soil around a tree. If you see anybody doing that, please tell them it's bad for the tree and ask them not to do it.
Yeah, the trunk is actually, it looks really solid. It looks like it's this, you know, big tough thing, but actually the bark is a kind of delicate and susceptible part of a tree because it can be rotted away, and bad things can happen to it if you don't keep stuff away from the trunk of a tree. We have a caller on line 2, Fran from Oak Lawn. Are you there, Fran?
I am here.
What's your question about trees?
Well, I have a question. First of all, I want to say that it's very refreshing to hear this program actually speaking to the subject, plants. Hello. What do you have, Mike locked up in a closet somewhere? Anyway, number one, I own 10 acres out in the boonies. Can't put a house on it yet because I don't have enough money. But the oaks, that I've been converting it back to woodland and savanna and prairie and whatnot. And the oaks are now big enough that wherever they drop acorns regularly. And I pack up bags of them, and I just give them out to the kids at school. Why don't you try that? You get them young. Get them while they're young. And number two, I wanted to know if you can tell me about the advisability and the availability of Halesia. It's called Silverbell in this area. They keep saying everything's going to, you know, be getting warmer in this area, and I'm thinking it might be a tree that could survive now in northern Illinois.
Silverbell.
I don't know what Silverbell is, I'm afraid.
Yeah,
what kind of tree is that?
It reaches up into southern Illinois. It's a real pretty tree. But they say zone 5, but I think it's probably zone 6. But, you know, they say it's going to be getting warmer here, and I've seen them before, and they're just lovely trees. Halesia, Halesia.
Well, yeah, they do say that as a result of climate change, we might be sort of edging up into zone 6 around here.
Yeah.
My basic advice would be, you know, if you can get one cheap,
yeah,
try it out.
Right.
You know, see what happens.
And there are more southern trees some fruit trees and things like magnolias that will sometimes thrive in Chicago area if they're in a sheltered location protected from the wind.
Yeah, like among my oak trees?
Well, maybe. The danger in the Chicago climate is that, you know, even though the overall average climate might be getting a little bit warmer, the characteristic of the Chicago climate is you have all these wild temperature swings and variations.
Yeah.
So you might get away with it for a couple of winters that happen to be mild, and then we'll get one of those other kind of Chicago winters that's like, you know, Siberia, and there goes your tree. So, you know, it can be, using the more southern species can be kind of a risky proposition. If you, but, you know, on the other hand, if you get it cheap enough,
Yeah. Okay, fair enough.
And climate change isn't going to, we aren't just going to wake up one day and all of a sudden it's zone six everywhere instead of just near the lake. We are going to have a lot more turbulence, I think, for
right.
a number of years. That's part of the change. And so that means that one season may be very different from the next season. So plants that are vulnerable are going to be maybe even more vulnerable for a while.
So, you know,
but
yeah.
Nice do a scientific experiment with one tree, maybe.
Yeah.
See what happens.
Yeah. So, okay. I'm sorry?
I said, okay.
Okay, great. Well, thanks very much for calling in. We
sure.
really appreciate it.
I'm so glad you're doing that habitat enhancement on your land. That's great to hear.
It's great to hear. Creates habitat for wildlife and everything else.
I'm toying around with the idea of converting it legally to a conservation easement.
Right. Open lands work does conservation easements. So if you wanted part of your land protected in perpetuity, I believe there is a bit of a tax break with the state. But anyway, we'd be glad to talk to you about that if you decide that there's
cool.
part of it you'll never, in your lifetime want to develop.
Yeah, you can find more information about all these things at openlands.org. We've also got a lot of links to the things we're talking about at the program on Mike's website at mikenovak.net or on my blog at growinginchicago.com.
Say that again.
Mikenovak.net is the website for the radio show, and
yeah.
openlands.org is the website for Open Lands.
Okay. And thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks very much for calling in.
Mm-hmm. And Beth, I wanted to say a thing about when we were talking about volcano mulching. Of course, the other thing that you touched on already also is that you don't want to pile soil or mulch or anything too high, even out from the tree, because the roots need oxygen. So you don't want to bury, the surface so deep that the roots can't get oxygen.
Yeah.
Because most of the roots of a tree, unlike what many people think, grow within a foot or a foot and a half of the surface and then just spread out wide.
Yeah, the important thing about trees is, you actually think about them. They're not just sort of inanimate objects like the sidewalk or the light poles. They're actually alive.
Yes.
And they have a relation. They have roots, and they have a relationship with the environment all around them. So it's important to actually think about them. We're going to have to go to Rick DeMaio Weather. So we want to say so long to Glenda. I know you have to go pick up the birthday cake.
That's right.
For the Tree Keeper's 20th anniversary this afternoon at Columbus Park. And I will be there, so I guess I'll see you there, Glenda.
See you there. And the weathermen tell him it's raining where I am.
Well, bring an umbrella. Bring an umbrella. Bring the rain slicker. These are tree keepers. They're tough. It's not going to stop.
That's right.
All right, great. Well, thanks
Thank
a lot,
you.
Glenda.
Thank you.
Rick, you there?
No, we're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we'll launch into Rick DeMaio Weather in just a second.
Because okay.
Rick DeMaio Weather and the Mike Novak Show are brought to you by our friends from the Care of Trees. And they have a tip for you. Did you know that according to realtors, trees can account for as much as 10% of property's value? In this housing market, you need to consider all of your assets, especially your trees. So take care of them and consider having a certified arborist evaluate the trees before you sell your home or before you buy one. A good inspection involves assessing the trees from top to bottom, analyzing everything that could affect their health, and determining whether they pose a threat to property and safety. An arborist from the Care of Trees will look for disease and harmful insects, will gauge the health and structural integrity of the trees, and will then persist a written report. Pardon me. A written report noting any problems and recommending corrective measures. Whether you want to make sure all is well with the trees in your yard, you're changing your landscaping, or you're moving, invite the certified arborist at the Care of Trees to take a look. See thecareoftrees.com or call 847-394-4220. That's 847-394-4220. The Care of Trees. Their business is people and their love for trees.
This is
Season yet. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. Invest a bit of time now to ensure a bountiful harvest and beautiful landscape throughout the season. And include Milorganite, eco-friendly all-purpose fertilizer, as part of your formula for success. Use Milorganite organic nitrogen fertilizer in all your planting beds. The low nitrogen, slow release formula makes Milorganite goof-proof and good for the environment. So choose Milorganite for better results naturally. Available wherever garden supplies are sold.
This is WCPT. This is the Mike Novak Show. I'm Beth Potts, sitting in for Mike Novak. And we're going to talk to Rick DeMaio about the weather for gardeners and other weather phenomena. You there, Rick?
I'm here, Beth. How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
You know what? I'm kind of chewing on something right now. I made these amazing pancakes yesterday.
Oh, and here's pancakes the thing. Sound it, good.
Yeah, but this is what I did. I did something different, okay? And let me finish the chew here for a minute, okay?
Okay.
Okay, there it is. All right. So what I do is I
have to question the strategy of making pancakes at a moment when you know you're going to be on the radio.
No. Here's the thing. I made them yesterday, okay?
Okay.
And I added a little bit of sugar, a little bit of vanilla, a touch of cinnamon, and then I crushed up some walnuts, because if you put big walnuts in pancakes and don't cook the right way, you get that little runny, kind of drippy stuff off the side.
Yeah.
And then I had a couple of delicious organic bananas, and I put them in there, and they were fantastic. I had to feed three boys for breakfast, and, of course, one of them said, I don't want anything on my pancakes. So I made his without the walnut, but I had some extra batter left over, so I made these, like, two huge, humongous pancakes where – you ever make the pancakes so big you need, like, two spatulas to pick it up?
Right, right.
which is what I did yesterday. And then I'm looking at it, I'm like, well, this is so big, I can't eat it today. I'll eat it tomorrow. I don't know why, but this pancake, microwaved after you cook it,
yes,
you know, a day later, yeah, almost tasted better. It was sometimes when, you know, you make pasta, and then the next day you go, you know what, this tastes better than yesterday.
Pancakes freeze and re-microwave or toast brilliantly, just like waffles. I will make a big fresh batch. We'll put them in the freezer bag for the kids, and they get fresh ones instead of the, you know, Eggo my Eggo kind.
What I like to do is I like to put a little piece of wax paper in between them so that they will actually separate.
Oh, that's a good one. Yeah, because this morning when I was microwaving them, they kind of got got glued together there for a minute. But Heather, I like that. I never really thought about making more ahead of time and using the next day.
Oh, yeah. They freeze wonderfully.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. I when I see frozen pancakes in the supermarket, I go, look, how can you freeze a pancake?
Well, you can just smell the conveyor belt they came off of. You know?
Yeah,
it's not really.
Yeah.
You know, if it's in a kitchen.
And you can taste it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So, and you know what? I think sometimes when you know, you cook one morning, on the next one you go, I don't feel like cooking again. So might as well cook twice as much and you can enjoy it the next day. So isn't that how Sunday mornings are supposed to be, Beth?
Theoretically, yes, for those who are not on the radio.
Yeah. I haven't had a Sunday morning in over 2 years.
Yeah, so, I mean, Heather, you kind of know the deal here. You know, Beth, I heard the previous caller talking about wanting to get something because he understands the weather is, you know, warming up and the climate is warming up. And then the other person that you had on the phone said, well, make sure that you understand that even though it's warming, it's doing so in a highly variable way. And my gosh, has this summer been nothing but highly variable since about the first or second week of June, Beth?
It has been, and it messes with my head, because I get this idea that, oh, you know, it's raining, it's really wet, and then, you know, I notice all of a sudden when I'm digging in the garden, I notice that it's like dry a foot down.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, that's how the month of June was: incredibly wet, very cloudy, very cool. And then we got into the month of July, which was incredibly hot and humid. And it's interesting, Beth, I don't know how much you keep track of the corn crop, but the corn crop has actually been rated much lower than expected as far as favorable yield, compared to previous years, based on the fact that it was too hot in some areas across central Illinois this past summer.
Well, I do not actually keep track of the corn crop all that closely, but I have noticed that there are parts of my garden that are amazingly dry.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, you know, wow, it's the middle of September, and I'm going to have to go home and like set up a sprinkler.
Okay, this is the good thing about talking to me today. You don't have to worry about a sprinkler between now and Tuesday morning, because the weather system that's over us currently is now beginning to shift back northward and bring with it a lot of moisture. So this is part of the variability that we've seen, because the month of July, even though, and this is the strange thing about numbers lately, Beth, is we had the fourth warmest July ever in Illinois, the second warmest summer nationally. But yet for Illinois, we went down, at least for the Chicago metropolitan area, it went down as the wettest July on record, and that was only because we had, within a 24-hour period, nearly 8 inches of rain at the official point where we measure rainfall, which is obviously O'Hare Field. But the rest of the area, if you go south of even Interstate 80, it was very dry this past summer. And, in fact, even when we did get the rain, it was very, very heavy in some very localized areas. So what you have with that, and you know better than anybody, is you have very, very extreme amounts of runoff. You don't get that rainfall percolating deep into the soil. So while if, you know, you may have gotten 8 inches of rain in the rain gauge, the ground actually wasn't able to, you know, soak a lot of that up, and it only fell in a very small area. And once we got into the month of August, August was actually the only normal month around here for the last, like, 6 months where we had temperatures a couple of days in the 90s, but then, as you know, we had some very, very hot weather at the beginning of the month, and if you recall, the last day of August 31st and the first 2 days of September, we had temperatures in the mid to upper 90s in some parts of central Illinois. This is some of the amazing facts that I got out of this past summer, was Springfield, Illinois, had four consecutive days where the afternoon high temperature was exceeded. In other words, it was a record that was established. And three of those days, the temperature had 100 degrees. When was the last time we've seen 100-degree temperatures in September? So whatever moisture you had in the ground was essentially evaporated right out of that. We haven't really had a good soaking rain in nearly a month and a half, but that's going to change over the next 36 hours, Beth.
Yeah, and, you know, to help rain soak into your lawn, it's a really good thing to core aerate it, and this is a good time of year do that.
Yeah, and I just noticed the apartment where I live, they did a lot of that in the lawns, and this is the time to do it because otherwise, if the soil gets a little bit too cold, like it has over the past couple of days, it gets compacted, and that's the one thing I know Mike talks about a lot.
Yeah.
And it doesn't aerate, and it doesn't allow that rainfall to soak in. But even though we've had some pretty crazy weather around here the last 3 weeks, and when someone said, they go, boy, this September has been rather cool, I'm like, you know what, you're right, it has been cool, but at the same time, we started out blazingly hot, and then next thing you know, and this is the odd thing about September, and I always think the odd thing about November. For some reason, September, people aren't really sure like how it's supposed to be. You know that the first week is usually the end of summer, but you're kind of holding on to that warm weather.
Right.
And by the time you get to about the 15th or 20th, you kind of accept the fact that you're not going to be wearing shorts as much. And you're saying, oh, you know what, okay, I'll accept fall. And then you get a couple of nice days and you go, you know what, I kind of want that fall weather back a little bit. And then you get into October and we're like, okay, I'm wearing a jacket, I'm wearing jeans, I'm wearing, you know, shoes that I hadn't worn since last year. And October is the kind of month to me, from a climatological standpoint, that usually kind of does what it's supposed to do. Then you get into November, and then the first part of November could still be somewhat nice, and the end of the month, we're shoveling snow. And then all of a sudden, it's wintertime. So I think September and November are kind of those bookend months, similar to how the month of March is, where March is kind of a bookend month from the wintertime to the springtime. And then June is the same way, I think, as November, where you're saying, isn't it supposed to be summer now? And it's still like in the 50s and 60s in some areas. So
yeah.
The rainfall, which is what I was leading up to, over the next 24 to 36 hours now appears to be forecast, and some of the models are looking at maybe about an inch and a half to maybe 2 inches of rain. So this is going to be very, very beneficial rain. Hopefully it'll hold off in time for the Bears and Packers to get their big game in today, which is going to be a late start. It's going to be a 3:30 start. I got a feeling they're going to be playing in some very, very wet field conditions by the end of the second half.
Well, let it be a challenge to them.
Yeah, without a doubt, right? They're big guys. They can handle it.
Yeah, I think a lot of people think in September, you know, when they see the leaves start to turn, they sort of turn off their gardening. And
yeah,
September is actually a really good month to do a lot of things in the garden.
Yeah, you know, you make a good point about that, because I remember when I had a nice big garden, gets to the year, you go, I don't need to do this, I don't need to do that. But it's almost like August is that month where you kind of lay back and just enjoy everything. In September, it's almost like a lot of prep work for the following year. But in your professional opinion, Beth, have you noticed that these leaves are turning a little bit earlier? Is this about right for some type of trees?
Well, I'm told that that's yet another thing about the Midwestern climate that's mm-hmm. highly variable. Mm-hmm. And it responds to a particular pattern of weather. If you have sunny days and you have cool nights, which we have certainly had.
Absolutely, yeah.
That's what triggers it's actually the pigment retreat, the chlorophyll retreating from the leaves and showing the underlying pigment.
Right, and I would think sunlight would have a lot to do with that, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would. The sunlight, it's having sunny days. And we haven't had them in the last couple of days, but we had a lot of sunny days before that.
No, we haven't. In fact, I think the last time, even though yesterday afternoon turned out to be kind of nice in the for about a 3 or 4 hour period, I don't expect anything from a sunny sunny weather of long duration probably until Wednesday. So we're getting definitely into another 3 or 4 days of at least a solid overcast and rain. I don't have the numbers in front of me as far as how much sun we should typically see for this month, but I know it's been below normal. I've been following a couple of these great websites out of Wisconsin and Michigan. They're basically very, very simple websites that anybody can Google, just travelwisconsin.org. Or I think it's travelwisconsin.com, rather, and they give the fall foliage update. And for some reason, the people who run these particular sites are very, very into the changing of the colors of the trees, obviously because it adds to their local economy. But typically, these sites will have all these photographs from all these different, forest preserves and Department of Natural Resource sites that are run by the state and federal government, and they really are quite alluring to see, these small ponds in northern and central Wisconsin just glittering with just gorgeous reds and yellows and oranges, where around here in Illinois, we don't really have much to offer other than, a few parks in the northern part of the state. But it does seem that the leaves are definitely turning a little bit earlier than normal across northern Wisconsin and definitely Michigan, Beth.
Yeah, well, of course, the leaves starting to turn is a signal that the leaves will soon be dropping.
Yeah,
and
without a doubt.
In a minute, we're going to get to Brianne Heath from Growing Home, who's going to talk to us some more about leaves and composting and what you can do with all those leaves to make the best use of them in the fall. I wouldn't do anything in the garden over the next few days because Rick says that the soil's going to be wet. You don't want to be digging in the garden or walking in the garden when it's wet. But once it dries out, it's going to be a great time to plant trees. I planted a whole bunch of trees and shrubs yesterday. Going to be a great time to plant trees. Going to be a great time to spread compost and mulch. Going to be a great time to divide perennials. It's going to be a great time to do a lot of things in the garden over the next month or so.
Yeah, and Beth, before we get to the 5-day forecast, you guys have to take a quick break to do anything, or do you want me to get into that right now?
Okay, that's great. Can you give us the 5-day and the 4-week forecast?
Yeah, sure. Well, obviously, rain today, rain tomorrow, as I mentioned. Long-range models basically are telling us that this is going to be the wettest 2 to 3 days, probably out of the next 2 weeks. So the rain right now showing up on the radar, I think it's going to be kind of hit and miss for the afternoon. You'll get some nasty downpours, and it'll stop, and then some nasty downpours, and it's up. I don't think we're going to see as much sunshine as we did yesterday. And obviously that sun made things pretty nice once the rain did clear out. We made it up in the low 60s. But basically low 60s today, normal high is right around 72, so a full 10 degrees below average. Then maybe low to mid-60s tomorrow, but all that warmth is going to bring up quite a bit of moisture, so about 3/4 of an inch of rainfall late this afternoon and tonight. I wouldn't be surprised to see maybe another inch during the day on Monday. Then it begins to slowly clear out around here as far as rain is concerned on Tuesday. Still remains cloudy, still somewhat cloudy with some better chance of sun on Wednesday. And then everything looks really nice, Beth. Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, even Tuesday the following week. And you're saying, well, how can you go out this far with the forecast? But all the long-range charts indicate that everything that's been over us for the last 5 days shifts off to the east. And as long as the tropical storm and hurricane season doesn't get too active again, which I don't think it will, we should remain very, very favorable for dry conditions and garden work and a lot of soil restoration in some areas that may get a little compacted and muddy. Between probably, I would say, about the 27th of September and about the 5th of October. Right now, long range for October appears to be mild and dry for the first 2 weeks. Beyond that, I don't think I can go much further than that, but at least the rainy weather over the next 2 days will probably be the rainiest between now and probably next week, Beth.
All right. Well, this all sounds like good news for gardeners, Rick, and thanks very much for the weather forecast. Mike, I'll talk to you again next week.
Okay. Take care, Beth. I'll see you around.
Okay.
Okay, bye.
You might have gathered we enjoy music here at the Mike Novak Show. So we'd like to invite you to bust a move while busting up clay soil. You want to wait till after this rain is done. But busting up clay soil, courtesy of Cotton Burr Compost from Back to Nature. This all-natural product is made from composted cotton burrs, which will break up your soil better than your best breakdancing moves. And it will keep your pants cleaner, too. And it will condition your soil. Cotton burr compost from Back to Nature is rich in protein, which is the primary food source for beneficial soil organisms. And it retains moisture like a champ, unlike peat moss. Find out more about cotton burr compost and other fine products from Back to Nature at backtonaturecompost.com. That's backtonaturecompost.com. Dr. Wally at Pesci's and Mike both love it, so give it a try. Back to Nature products are available at Knupper's Nursery and Landscape in Palatine, Illinois, Castle Gardens in Volo and Richmond, Illinois, and Bob's Salt and Feed in West Chicago, Illinois. So get busting with Back to Nature. Life does not start with the seed. It starts with the soil.
Spending more time at home these days? Give yourself some room. Renovate your basement or attic. You'll increase your living space and your home's resale value, too.
Trust DR Services Unlimited, 847-998-1687 for your remodeling needs, including additions, renovations, and other home improvements. Rated A-plus by the Better Business Bureau and recommended on Angie's List. DR is a proud member of NARI. DR provides exceptional quality at a fair price. Contact DR at 847-998-1687 or at RestoreTheNorthShore.com.
Okay, we're back on the Mike Novak Show. This is Beth Botts sitting in for Mike Novak, and we have Brianne Heath from Growing Home here talking about compost. And let's talk about leaves and compost.
Okay, as we talked about earlier, leaves are turning colors now, and then they'll start to fall. And they'll start to fall, in a few weeks and then continue on probably out throughout the end of November.
And why? What do you do with leaves in a compost bin? I mean, what are they useful for?
They actually provide the nice ratio that you want in your compost bin. Generally, you'll put in two times the amount of browns as you will the amount of greens. And what I mean by greens and browns is that, things that are brown in color, like leaves, newspaper, straw, versus things that are green in color, like, grass clippings or green garden waste.
And you don't want to just sort of dump it in there. You want to like mix it up some, right?
Right. Yeah. You want to mix it up, usually in alternating layers. And then also keeping in mind, you don't just have layers of greens versus browns. You also have to consider air as a layer and then also soil as a layer.
Okay, so you throw some soil in there. What does that do for you?
It kind of gets things started. So your browns, things like the fall leaves, are really primarily decomposed by fungi.
Okay.
And once that stuff starts to break down, then you'll have the bacteria set in, and they'll mostly decompose things that are green, but then they'll also decompose some of the other plant parts or inside of the leaves.
So the actual work of this is being done by the microorganisms, the fungi, the insects,
mm-hmm.
that and their eggs are in the soil. So the all the life that needs to be in your compost bin actually can sort of be inoculated by throwing in a couple of shovels full of soil.
Right. You could do that. Or, if you're pulling out plants from your garden, there's going to be some soil clinging to the roots. That's also just fine. The only thing you want to really avoid doing is, maybe composting in a plastic bin with just, very clean food scraps. It's going to take a lot longer for those microorganisms to find those things.
Okay. So you can use food scraps, but you sort of have to mix them in.
Right.
One of the things that I always do with my compost is I always sift it. I use a plastic milk crate, personally. I'm very high-tech. But I understand that you have some new technology for sifting compost at the Tsukasa Garden.
Right, yeah. I mentioned earlier that at our Tsukasa Garden, we have up to 20 cubic yards of compost in various stages at any given point. And especially now at this time of year, a lot of it has finished. It's been sitting out all summer. And then we're also anticipating a lot of the garden waste, a lot of leaves coming in. So taking it out, sifting it, spreading it onto the garden is what we want to do. Usually in a day, because we're doing job training, I'll have anywhere from 3 to 5 people helping me do things like sifting the compost, you know, planting, clearing out weeds, things like that. And it's a pretty tedious job. Sifting compost by hand really involves a screen, you know, like a plastic milk crate like you have, or a piece of hardware mesh stretched over a wooden frame. And you'll usually put that over a wheelbarrow and just sift it by hand.
Yeah, and very, very briefly, what's your new technology?
Well, we created a bicycle-powered sifter. So instead of doing everything by hand with shovels, you load it into a sort of retrofitted compost tumbler and then just pedal, and it goes very, very quickly.
So you can garden or you can work out and compost simultaneously.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
That's awesome. It's like the exercycle that produces all this great, great stuff for your garden. That's really, really cool. We're talking to Breanne Heath of Growing Home here. We're talking about compost. We're talking about leaves. We're talking about soil. We're talking about all that good stuff. This is the Mike Novak Show. I'm Beth Botts. I'm sitting in for Mike Novak. We're taking your garden questions, if you have any, at 773-838-WCPT. That's 773-838-9278. Or if you tweet, Mike is at Mike Now on Twitter, and I am at Chicago Gardener on Twitter. We're going to take a little break here for the news.
This hour of the Mike Novak Show is brought to you by The Care of Trees, our business's people and their love for trees, and by Back to Nature Compost. Life doesn't start with the seed, it starts with the soil. Here he is again, Mike Novak.
Well, no, he isn't, actually. Mike is off today, and this is Beth Botts sitting in for Mike Novak on the Mike Novak Show, the greening and gardening show for the Chicago area. We have with us Breanne Heath from Growing Home. We're talking about compost and mulch and soil and all that stuff. I have a mulch question that came in to my Twitter feed, which is at Chicago Gardener, about mulch and specifically about wood chips. It says, this is from the East Coast. He doesn't say which East Coast city, but from an East Coast city is giving away wood chips free. Can they be used or do they need to be aged? I will give my answer to this and then I'll ask Breanne what her answer would be. My answer is that when I can get free wood chips, I grab free wood chips. I use them mainly around established trees and shrubs. There is an issue with fresh, you know, just ground up wood chips that when they first start decomposing, there's a period of time when they consume a lot of nitrogen, and there's a current concern about them actually pulling nitrogen from the soil and actually robbing perennials and things like that from the soil. Well, I wouldn't personally use wood chips around my perennials because that's like, you know, spreading gravel in your perennial beds. It makes it really hard to dig or weed or anything in your perennial beds. So I use finer mulch such as leaves in my perennial beds. I don't hesitate to use the fresh wood chips around an established tree because I figure that tree has a big enough root system that stretches way, 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 way out beyond the mulch ring. And that tree's going to be able to hold its own against that nitrogen deprivation for a few months. After a few months, the wood chips will you know, they'll go into another stage of decomposition, and the benefits of having mulch over the roots and keeping the lawnmowers away from the trunk of the tree way outweigh the problem that you might have from spreading fresh wood chips. The other thing is, I have no place to compost a big pile of fresh wood chips. So basically, I don't bother. I'm just careful about where I use them. What do you think about this question, Brianne?
Well, I think it's definitely a good idea to let the wood chips age. So when they're fresh, they're more of that yellow or bright wood-colored.
Yeah.
And when they're aged, they're more of a brown, and they'll start decomposing quite a bit. So what we do, and again, because we're a nonprofit and we are doing landscaping training, and we do have the space to let our wood chips age, is we'll get them fresh. You know, when the city's going out cutting down trees, they'll come over and dump a load in the yard, and they'll sit for anywhere from a few weeks to a few months, just depending on how long it takes. And actually, during that time, you'll see a lot of heat coming out of that pile. And it's true that they do tie up a lot of the nitrogen in the soil. Now, I don't really differentiate between using wood chips on perennial beds versus on trees, just because, again, you know, a nonprofit, we're making do with what we have.
Sure.
But one thing I will point out is that the texture of the wood chips does matter a little bit. So if you're using very thick wood chips, I would definitely put those more around trees that are very established or shrubs that are very established. If they're a very fine texture, they've been more shredded than chipped, I think that might be okay for the perennial beds.
Yeah, just generally on perennial beds, you like it to be a little finer. You like it to be a little easier to work. And also something that's... Am I right in thinking that something that's a smaller particle is going to break down faster?
That's true. Right.
And you know, a lot of people say, oh, my mulch doesn't last. Oh, I have to keep putting on this mulch every year. But actually having your mulch break down is a good thing.
Right. That means that you have some healthy soil bacteria and fungi in there digesting everything. So if your mulch isn't breaking down, I'd be worried about the quality of your soil.
That's a good tip. So if you actually, you know, you think, oh, I've got this great garden triumph because I've figured out this low maintenance way to garden and I've spread all this mulch and it's still there 3 years later. Actually, you probably don't have the best kind of soil because it's the let me make sure I'm getting this right. It's the microorganisms and insects and so forth that feed on that top layer of plant debris that actually release the nutrients to the roots of the plants.
Right, that's correct.
So I use leaves. I shred leaves. I'm very happy this year because I got a brand new, haven't tried it yet because there are no leaves, electric leaf shredder.
Oh, wow. I'd love to have one of those.
Yes, it's my present to myself, my new garden gadget this year. I've been using one of those, leaf blower vacuum things, and if you use the vacuum part, it has a leaf shredder in there. But that's really heavy to tote around. So this is the one where you just leave the shredder in one place and you feed the leaves into it. And supposedly it makes this really nice. It reduces the volume of the leaves and creates this really nice fine mulch, which is really good on the perennials. So what else can you tell folks about composting? Any big mistake you see people making with compost bins and compost piles?
I think probably the biggest mistake is not turning them often enough. Like I mentioned, the air is a really essential layer in the compost pile. And, you know, turning your pile every, say, 3 to 4 weeks will really help it break down a lot faster. Because if you think about those microorganisms, they need oxygen to breathe. And the more oxygen they have available, the faster they're going to be, you know, chomping everything down.
We have now Ed Lyon on the phone. Ed is a horticulturist, a writer, and he's also the director of the Allen Centennial Gardens up in Madison, Wisconsin. And I understand that Ed also wants to chime in on the subject of wood mulch. Ed, you there?
Yes, I'm here.
What do you have to say about wood mulch?
Well, I no longer use the free wood mulch, and that comes from Urban Environments. And I tell all of our folks here to be very cautious of it. There's some research that's been done, and by the University of Wisconsin in Madison, that does show that one of the most insidious of pathogens we have up here, which is Verticillium wilt, can be transferred through that mulch. It can survive. We have Verticillium wilt killing a large number of trees up here. So if you're using wood mulch that has Verticillium wilt, there's some chance that you will then, using it under trees, transfer that to highly susceptible trees, which here are maples and red buds. There's also some thought and concern. They're doing research on it. There's a possibility it might also transfer oak wilt, which is another huge issue up here. Obviously, they're telling people compost it as long as you can, but they're finding even after composting wood mulch after a year, the Verticillium wilt is still there. So it goes back to I advise people that sometimes spending a little bit of money isn't the worst thing. So we buy the wood mulch that's been heat treated so we can feel a little more comfortable that we're not spreading those pathogens around.
So you think it's better that it goes to the big commercial composting operation where they have the big long windrows and they turn it a lot and it gets really hot?
Exactly. And keep in mind, where is all of this free shredded bark or shredded wood coming from in a municipality? It's coming from the things that people have cut out of their home landscapes that had problems. So you could very well be more likely to get branches and bark and all this tree matter that had an issue, like Verticillium wilt or oak wilt. So that's what I tell everybody. Keep in mind where all this free stuff is coming from. It's from stuff that probably died some way. So,
Brianne, you have something to say?
Oh, yeah. Ed, isn't it true that Verticillium will break down or no longer really be a threat as a plant pathogen after it reaches about 122 degrees? So with the idea that if you let not only your wood chips age, but age in a hot pile where you're actually seeing that steam come off, that it wouldn't be such of an issue?
I couldn't hear her response.
Brianne was suggesting that if you age that compost in a hot pile that reaches at least 120 degrees, so you actually get the compost hot enough that the steam is coming off of it, that would actually take care of the Verticillium wilt. Have you heard that?
Yes, exactly. And that's why I recommend going and purchasing it from a site that has done that. The homeowner, I find in most cases, they want to get the mulch. They want to put it down right away. Most homeowners do not have a real good place to pile the mulch, and usually they can't make large enough piles to get that kind of heat. And there's a lot of work involved in constantly mixing that and making sure everything in that pile has reached that heat at some point in time. Now, up here, you go and you buy some shredded hardwood mulch. You're paying, $20 to $25 a yard. That's not really expensive when you consider that the free stuff that you'd be getting from a municipality could be transferring something that's deleterious to your trees.
And, this whole issue of having a big enough pile and getting it hot enough is an issue for home compost piles, right?
Exactly. Now, commercial sites probably could do that much easier. Like your guest who is discussing this with us, they probably can do some very large piles. They may, bring this stuff in, let it sit for several years. But for the average homeowner, it's not likely they're going to do that. They're going to bring it in. They want to use it right away. They don't want to tie up space in their yard to create a compost pile that really will heat effectively, to that kind of temperature.
So, Brianne, how large does a home compost pile have to be to really effectively compost?
There's conflicting research, either 3 by 3 by 3 feet or 4 by 4 by 4 feet, with the idea that that size is kind of the ultimate size or the optimal size to get in both oxygen, but then also create a mass large enough for the bacteria and the fungi and any of the other microorganisms to really digest everything and create the heat as a byproduct. So, you know, they have those really long compost thermometers. They might be 2 or 3 feet long. You can actually stick them in the middle and see how hot your compost bin is getting. If you're decomposing mostly plant material, especially plant material that might have pathogens in it, you want to get it at least to 120 degrees, 122 degrees for several days. If you're decomposing things like, say, animal waste, you want to get it to at least 145 degrees for several days.
So personally, I would not put animal waste in my compost pile because I just don't think any of my bins are going to get big enough and hot enough. And if I have any doubt at all about something, if it's a weed with seeds or I pull a lot of deadly nightshade out of my garden that has those poisonous berries, I just put that in the landscape waste because that's going to go away to the commercial composting operation where they have the gigantic piles that they turn with like bulldozers. And they turn them all the time, and they get really, really hot. And I have a lot more confidence that things that are potentially pathogens or any diseased, like if I had tomato diseases, I'm not going to put the diseased tomato plants in my home compost pile because I want to be absolutely sure it's going to go someplace where it's in a big pile that's going to get hot enough to kill whatever bad things are lurking. Talking about compost, compost is one of the things that you can do to make your soil good for bulbs. And Ed, I specifically asked you to come on the show today to talk to us about bulbs because we're getting up toward the time of year when bulbs are appearing in the garden centers and it's getting on for time to plant bulbs, isn't it?
Exactly. In fact, ours are on their way from Holland as we speak. And so expected to arrive around the first of the month, and somewhere around the middle of the month, we'll be putting all of ours at Allen Centennial Gardens in the grounds. And, of course, we speak in terms of thousands as opposed to hundreds. So, yeah, that time is coming.
And what is it about fall? What in the fall triggers us to know that it's time to plant bulbs? Is it just somebody told us October?
Yeah, and you can actually plant bulbs right up until the time that the ground freezes so solid that you can't put them in. So that's not the cold temperatures are not an issue. I've actually put daffodils in with a pickaxe. Not that I would recommend waiting that long, but it certainly doesn't harm those plants to put them in late. We generally do it in October because we have it's nice enough weather, so it's comfortable for us. It's not really an issue with the bulbs. We don't put them in much earlier than that because if we get really warm temperatures, there's a possibility that you're going to stimulate them to start sprouting. And in most cases, even a little bit of sprouting isn't going to hurt them. But we like to put them in at that ideal time where they know it's cold enough to go through that dormancy period without pushing any new growth. And yet not so cold that we don't want to be out there putting them in the ground.
So talk to me about this dormancy period. A lot of people ask me, oh, I forgot to plant my bulbs in the fall. Can I plant them in the spring? But that's not really going to work, right?
Well, they can plant them in the spring, and they will grow, but they're not likely to get flowers. The dormancy is what's going to stimulate the flowering on the plant. So by all means, don't throw them away. If you have room where you can chill them and you want to look up each bulb and what amount of chilling it takes, you can certainly put them in the refrigerator. If you're doing any number of bulbs, of course, that's going to take a lot of room. But if you can save them over, don't throw them away. You can still plant them. You'll get vegetation. You just won't get flowering until the following year.
Well, another thing that I've done sometimes with sort of intermittent success is I take the bulbs I forgot to plant. Sometimes I've actually waited for one of those January warm spells that we get because of our erratic weather and gone out there and found unfrozen places in the soil and planted these things under the snow in January. But another thing that I've sometimes tried doing is planting them in a container and then putting the container in some place, like the pot in the garage or some place where it's going to chill, but it's not going to freeze.
Exactly.
Do you do that at the garden?
Yes, we do it at the gardens. There's a number of really good gardeners up here in the Madison area that do that. In fact, one of our really good gardeners has extremely small amounts of room in his garden to dedicate to bulbs, so he does almost all of his bulbs that way. What we do at the gardens, because if you, like you said, you can't really keep that container out. There's going to be at least a 20-degree difference because those bulbs aren't in the ground. They're in an elevated container. What we do is we take plastic nursery pots, and almost everybody ends up having them left over. We plant up pots, nursery pots that we think are either going to be the size of the container we're going to put them in, or maybe it'll take multiple containers. We plant them, and we have a nice vegetable garden that we bury them. So they're essentially planted, but then when we start seeing them come up and we know they're ready for the containers next spring, we simply lift up these plastic nursery pots where the bulbs all started. You can then either transplant them, or if you've used containers that are similar in size to your decorative containers, you can just stick them right in that way.
That's real convenient because I don't have that magic place like a crawl space or an unheated garage where you can overwinter the pot. I have a very sort of constrained urban kind of gardening situation, which a lot of our listeners have. I want to let everybody know this is the Mike Novak Show on WCPT 820 AM. And I'm sitting in for Mike Novak today. My name is Beth Botts. I'm a gardener and blogger and whatnot in Chicago.
You're a master gardener, too, aren't you?
I'm a master gardener. I'm a tree keeper.
And
we have Breanne Heath from Growing Home here, the compost expert. We have Ed Lyon from the University of Wisconsin here. He's the bulb expert. And we're having some good conversation about gardening today.
Yeah. And how long were you writing the column for the Trib?
Oh, yeah. I was also on staff at the Chicago Tribune for 20 years until a couple years ago. I still freelance for the Chicago Tribune quite
some. Yeah, so I think you know a thing or two about gardening there, my friend.
I'm always learning. You're always learning. If you're a gardener, you're always learning.
Yeah.
And you discover, you get good surprises and bad surprises every year,
yeah.
I think.
Well, that's why we're here, the
Mike
Novak Show.
Here.
And we are here because of our dear friends from The Care of Trees, and they have another tip for you. From The Care of Trees, mulching is one of the best things you can do for your trees, as we've been discussing all morning long. And it's easy, inexpensive, and doesn't require special tools. Mulch suppresses weeds and keeps equipment like lawnmowers and string trimmers away from the tree and reduces trunk injuries that can be an opening for disease and insect damage. Mulching also moderates soil temperature and conserves moisture in the soil to help trees through dry spells. It increases the amount of organic material and activity around the roots that feed the tree. The most commonly used mulching materials, wood chips. Spread them around the base of the tree to at least 3 feet from the trunk or all the way out the width to the widest branches if you can. Don't make the mulch any thicker than 3 inches and do not allow it to touch the tree trunk, as everyone's been saying. Invite the certified arborist at The Care of Trees to take a look at your trees and see thecareoftrees.com or call 847-394-4220. That's 847-394-4220. The Care of Trees. Their business is people and their love for trees.
You can have a beautiful lawn and be kind to the environment, too. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. A few simple changes in your lawn care practices, like using Milorganite Goof-Proof Organic Fertilizer, can result in a carpet of green safe for your kids and pets. Start by raising the mowing height of your lawn, if you haven't done so already. Taller grass is better able to compete with the weeds. Mow often, removing only one-third of the total height, and leave the clippings on the lawn. Consider using a push or electric mower. It's good for the waistline and the environment. Further improve your lawn's health and greatly reduce weed problems with proper fertilization. Milorganite's organic nitrogen is slow release and won't burn your lawn, even in hot, dry weather. Plus, you don't need to water it in. And the non-staining iron helps maintain the deep green color, even in the heat of summer. So join the professionals and home gardeners who've trusted Milorganite for over 80 years. Use Milorganite for better results naturally. Available where garden supplies are sold.
This is the Mike Novak Show, Chicago's gardening and greening show. I am obviously not Mike Novak. I am Beth Botts, a garden writer and blogger jack of all garden trades.
Green-thumbed lady.
I'm here with Brianne Heath from Growing Home and Ed Lyon from the University of Wisconsin. We're talking composting and bulbs and any other garden questions. If you want to call in with a garden question, our telephone number for that, which I will find right here, is 773-838-WCPT. That's 773-838-9278. And, Ed, I had a specific question that I wanted to ask you, because it is a specific question that everybody always asks me, which is, how do I keep animals from not eating my bulbs?
Well, I can give you the short, simple answer, and then we can talk a little bit more about that. The simple answer I give people is don't grow tulips. Because actually, if you start looking at anything that's a non-tulip bulb, most of them either have a certain toxicity level to rodents, or they have something in them that makes them resistant. Everybody wants to do the tulips because that's where you're going to get all these wonderful bright colors and the purples and yellows and reds and oranges. But the problem is those are the ones that are most desirable both as bulbs and as plants for rabbits, deer, and other rodents to eat. Species tulips are especially delicacies to them. Now, most of the people understand that daffodils or anything in the narcissus family have a chemical in it. It's actually called lycorin. And that chemical can be toxic to animals and certainly would make them sick, so they don't eat it. What you need to know is the daffodil is in the amaryllis family. So any of the other bulbs in that same family also have lycorin in them, and that includes our snowflakes, which I think are grossly underused as a bulb.
That's Leucojum, the summer snowflake?
Exactly. Snowdrops, the Galanthus, and the Alliums, again, another underused plant. Most of them know the puffball on a stick form that you see at the end of May into June. But there are many smaller species that come out with the rest of your spring flowering bulbs, and they also have the lycorin in them as well. I do, at my own home garden, I do a large number of minor bulbs because almost every minor bulb that you put in the ground has some level of resistance to the rodents. The real issue are the tulips, and that's where you have to find some way to deter both them eating the bulb and, once those tulips are up, rabbits and deer love to mow off that vegetation.
Explain to me a little bit what you mean by minor bulbs.
Okay, minor bulbs are usually, and I'm not even sure what the absolute definition on that
well,
is.
Well, give us some examples.
Yeah, they're all these sort of smaller bulbs that are non-daffodil, non-tulips. And we're talking about things like the Glory of the Snow, which would be your Chionodoxa, your Fritillarias, which I absolutely love. There's a large number of really fun species of Fritillarias with different looks. It includes your Winter Aconite, which is Aranthus, your Grape Hyacinths, which I'm sure most of your audience are aware of, and the Phyllis, the little purple squills that many people do. So I think it's kind of, they tend to be smaller in size, and probably your basic definition is they are the non-daffodil tulip bulbs that aren't used as frequently for these great big displays.
I actually use a lot of minor bulbs, too, because I have a very shady garden, and I find that a lot of those bulbs will do well in the early spring. Most of them bloom in the early spring. They do well in the early spring before the trees leaf out, when there's sort of marginally more sunlight, but in my garden, although only marginally. We have a caller, Jeanette, on line two, who has questions about how to keep squirrels out of her bulbs. Now, you sort of answered this, Ed, but I wonder if you could talk a little bit about some of the physical barriers that people
use. Physical barriers, the one that's the
easiest. Well, let's get Jeanette on the line first.
Oh, okay, sure.
Jeanette, you there?
Hi, thanks. Yes, I am. Thanks for taking my call. And I did get part of that answer regarding how to keep animals, and particularly rodents, out and using different bulbs. And I have another question, if you don't mind, after the one about keeping squirrels out. I didn't used to have trouble with squirrels. It's quite amazing. And only, I'd say, in the past 10 years, but I've been gardening for 30 years. But in the past 10 years, the squirrels, they just want to eat everything except those narcissus, crocus, and things like that.
Yes, and squirrels are especially troublesome because even though we say some of these bulbs, the deer and rabbits won't eat them, squirrels may still dig them up. They may not eat them. They may not take them away. But they love the fact that you just disturbed that soil, and it's easy digging. And they'll dig them up just simply to see what you put under there. And, of course, we don't want that. The most common method that you hear people utilize, and I tried this once, and I just, because I like to mix my bulbs in my perennial beds, it's very difficult, I think, to do, and that is laying the chicken wire with enough space between it for the bulbs to come up through. I'm sure you've heard of that method where you lay that down over, sort of a layer over the bulbs so that they come up through it, but the squirrels can't get down through. I find that very labor-intensive, and again, like I said, to try to fit in all these wonderful little bulbs in between my perennials, I'm going to have all these chunks of wire in there that I don't like. There are other things that you can do, obviously, that are physical. Even though they're not allowed to advertise this because it's not labeled as a pesticide, there is a product that, in fact, I was pleased to see that Mike Novak's show advertises with. I use a product called Milorganite, and I have had enormously good luck with this product keeping deer, rabbits, and squirrels out of my garden in the first place. And I think if you can keep them out of the garden, that beats any other option that you might have. Milorganite is a low-grade fertilizer. I'm sure you've heard the advertisement. But because it is originally from human waste, these rodents do not like the smell. And I apply it probably four times a year in my garden. One of those times is right after I plant the bulbs. And I make sure I have a fair amount of Milorganite on top of the ground. So, again, that odor deters them. And I will also use it in the spring, particularly around the early flush of bulbs, my heuchers, and any other plants that the rabbits like to come in and mow off. I have had tremendously good success with it. Like I said, they're not allowed to advertise it as a deterrent, but it really works, and a lot of us up here use that. And you're putting it down, it's organic, it's a fertilizer, it has some iron, and because it's such a low-grade nitrogen, you can put a lot of it down, and it's not going to burn or hurt your plants.
Yeah, I used Milorganite on my lawn. It had not occurred to me to use it for this purpose in perennial and bulb beds. And, you know, if you're concerned about the odor, my experience has been that, you know, the odor is barely perceptible to humans. It's must be more perceptible to rodents, but it's barely perceptible to humans. The only time I've ever had trouble with the odor of with Milorganite was when I carelessly left an open bag of it out in the rain, and that was a little intense. But otherwise, it's these really, you know, clean, tidy little black pellets. You just sort of scatter it by handfuls or using a spreader. And you can buy it in most good garden centers.
And you can get a 40-pound bag for something like $7. So compared to a lot of the pre-made sprays, one of the things that I think also does work, and I tried it one year, is you can take your bulb that you're going to plant and spray the bulb itself with some of these liquid repellents. But once again, they're fairly pricey, and if you have a large number of bulbs that you're going to put in the ground, spraying them so it kind of really soaks into the exterior of that bulb and have some last stability, you can get a little pricey, but it does work.
So, Jeanette, that gives you some options.
It certainly does, and I've used fish emulsion before for entirely different reasons, but I don't believe the fertilizer can smell any worse than that.
No.
A day or two, you'll smell that malorganite. It's like when we all used to use the cocoa beans. The first day you put it down, it was almost overwhelming. But as I tell people, there with all of these issues when we're dealing with rodents, the deer and rabbits are huge problems up here. Sometimes there's a few of those. If we really have bad issues where we're really getting a lot of damage, then you have those trade-offs. So a day or two where you can actually smell it. And even then, when it does smell, it's an off odor, but it's not human fecal odor. I think that's where people would get concerned.
Yeah.
Great.
Well, thanks a lot for calling in, Jeanette.
Thank you very much. Great show.
Okay, thank you. On another line, we have Nikki from Michigan. She has a bulbs issue. It's not really a spring bulbs issue as much as a summer bulbs issue. Nikki, you there?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My sister-in-law was asking me this morning. She's bringing in a plant for the winter, elephant ears, and, you know, cuts it back and has the, do you call it a bulb or a tuber? I'm not sure, the bottom part. She wanted to know if she wanted to propagate it. Can she actually cut that in half, and would it grow two plants, or do you have to just buy another bulb?
No, if you have the colocasias or elephant ears that actually have bulbs, because a misconception is that they all do, and they don't all necessarily produce this nice bulb. That bulb, you will have to plant that again next year. You've got more size. You're going to get a larger elephant ear, but you are not going to split that bulb. You'll destroy it if you do that. If you want more, you'll have to buy more bulbs.
Okay. It was getting so large, she wanted to actually make it smaller, so she thought by splitting it that would work. But I can tell her that will not work then.
No, you could only use if it produces some offset bulbs, you could use them. But splitting a colocasia tuber right in half, you're more likely to damage it. Tell her to send all of her big ones up to me. we love it when they finally get to that size where, you know, you get these great big monstrous leaves, and it can take a few years to get them.
Yeah, this one's a couple years old, and I'll tell her, just enjoy the size.
Just enjoy the size. And, you know, you take them indoors, you want to pack them in something that's light and fluffy so air can get to them, but they won't get moist. Speaking of rodents, I have heard people use the cedar shavings that are sold for, like, gerbil cages. Or very, very dry shredded leaves. I wouldn't pack them in damp shredded leaves because you want to avoid them getting moldy or anything. What do you use, Ed?
Sand.
Mm-hmm. No?
It works extremely well. And you want, what we do, the play sand, especially if it gets a little moisture in it, can hold excess moisture. So we go to, like, landscape supply company, and we get what's called a builder's sand or torpedo sand. It's coarser.
Okay.
Keep in mind, so many of these bulbs are coming from Mediterranean areas or areas that are extremely gravelly and well-drained to begin with. So things in the nature of sands or a dry sawdust can work as well.
We just find sand
a little easier to monitor and not getting it, you know, too overly moist or underly so.
That's great. I never would have thought of sand. That I will give her that part of the message, too, then. Thanks so much.
Thanks for calling in. We appreciate it.
I used to store beets through the winter the same way.
Beets?
Oh, my.
Mm-hmm. Pack them in sand.
I bet that would work. Okay, thanks for calling.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
One of the things I wanted to talk to you about, Ed, was there are all these questions when you're planting bulbs about the whether you should add things when you're planting the bulbs. Should you amend the soil? Should you add bone meal? Should you add fertilizer? What are the general rules on what you do when you're planting the bulb?
Yeah, bone meal is obviously one of those things that's recommended. I tell people, though, the single biggest thing, and up here in the area where I live, in the Madison area, we tend to have heavier soils, and I'm sure many of your listeners have that same issue.
Oh, yeah, clay.
Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned before, almost every bulb that we grow is indigenous to areas of the world that are just the opposite of that. They're sandy, and they really need good drainage. I think the single biggest thing that you can do for the health of the bulbs you are planting is exactly as a follow-up to what you've been talking to about. Make sure you have good quality soils. Good quality soils with a lot of organic matter and compost are going to be better drained here in our Midwest locations. So I think drainage is probably more critical than even anything nutrient-wise you might be putting on those plants. And again, if you have good quality organic matter or compost in your soils, that's what the plants in nature are pulling all of their nutrition from in the first place.
Brianne, what kind of nutrients do plants get from compost?
Well, they get all of the major macro and micronutrients. So the macronutrients will be typically the nutrients that you'll see listed on those bags of fertilizer that you buy. So the NPK, nitrogen, potassium, and phosphorus. And I think a common mistake about using fertilizer versus compost is that, you know, maybe people think that all the plants need are those major nutrients, and that's really not true. So the micronutrients, things like magnesium or calcium or sulfur, are really essential to really healthy, vigorous plant growth and also disease resistance. And so if you think about all of the things that are going into the compost pile, maybe food scraps or eggshells or, garden waste, they already have all those things in them because those are already plants that grew up. And then when you decompose them, they get released back into the soil by those microorganisms that we talked about earlier.
Okay, that's great. We have a caller on line 3, Chris from Palatine, who has a question not about compost or about bulbs, but about deadheading annuals. Chris, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you for, again, taking the call. I live in an apartment, so I don't deal with issues like bulbs and transplanting, et cetera. But I do have several hanging baskets. I've got a couple of wave petunias in them that, you know, in the last month or so have been doing great. They didn't do too great over July and August, but now they're going to town. But my question is deadheading. Besides aesthetically, does it do any purpose to get rid of the, you know, spent flowers?
Well, it depends on the plant.
Petunias?
I think the wave petunias, Ed, am I right about this? The wave petunias have been bred so they pretty much don't need to be deadheaded?
Oh, I couldn't hear the question at all.
The question is about when you have annuals, when you have big pots of annuals, such as wave petunias, do you really need to deadhead? Is it just an aesthetic thing, or does it actually do anything for the health or the productivity of the plant?
Yeah, a large number of annuals, if they look like they're going on the downside and they're not producing new flowers, it certainly will stimulate them to do more flowering if you go in and deadhead them. Some of the ones that have been traditionally a problem in the past, you mentioned petunias. The other one that I quit doing for a number of years because you had to constantly deadhead it was the annual geranium or pelargonium. Many of these plants where that used to be an issue, they are now have new cultivars that are what they will call them self-cleaning. So if you look, and the plant, and they've labeled it as a self-cleaning annual, what that means is they will drop off that old dead flower head on their own. And the whole reason that you're removing the flower heads is that annuals are have evolved so that they are going to grow in one single season. So they have to produce a seed in order to do that. So if they quit flowering, that stimulates those flowers to go to seed, because the energy needs to go to that seed production to get done in 1 year, then they don't produce any more flowers. If you start taking those flowers off from the plant, the plant's like, oh my, I still have to produce seed to reproduce. So that's why it throws out more flowers. It's trying to do that so it can go to seed.
Oh, great. By the way, the gentleman from the University of Wisconsin, are you in Madison?
Yes, he's in Madison. This is Ed Lyon, the director of the Allen Centennial Gardens in Madison.
Yeah, I graduated from UW back in 73, so... My favorite building on the ag campus is Babcock Hall.
Is what?
Babcock Hall.
Babcock Hall. What is Babcock Hall, Ed?
Well, of course, that's where they produce Babcock ice cream.
Oh, well, whose favorite building wouldn't it be?
Yeah, they're the most pampered cows in the world, I think, are on the UW campus.
Well, geez. Another thing about annuals is, it's a little bit too late for this, but very often in August, pots of annuals will start to look sort of tired. They get kind of leggy. If in early August, late July or early August, you cut those things back, much of the time they will put out a new flush of growth and put out a new flush of flowers. At this time of year, it's a little bit late to do them. You know, in a month or so, we're going to be giving up on them anyway.
Right.
But it's a good thing to do in July or in August when they start to look a little bit tired and leggy. So thanks a lot, Chris, for your question, and thanks for calling in.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
This is the Mike Novak Show on WCPT. I am Beth Botts. I'm sitting in for Mike Novak. Folks, it's official. Autumn is here. But that doesn't mean that the gardening year is over. In fact, at Chicagoland Gardening Magazine, we coined a saying, it ain't over till it's over. Actually, Yogi Berra might have beat us to it, but you get the drift. Even in the Midwest, there's always something to do in your gardens, indoors and out. One thing you can do is do something I wrote about in the September-October issue of Chicagoland Gardening. You can steal other people's leaves and make compost. And shred them up in your fancy new electric leaf shredder. Or you can propagate your plants for next year, which is another thing I wrote about. And something else you can do is you can read about other people's gardens. In every issue of Chicagoland Gardening Magazine, there are pictures of beautiful gardens and articles from the professional and home gardeners who created these wonderful things. And you can find out all about how they got the inspiration and how you can get the inspiration for your own garden. And if you're really, really desperate for something to read and you're stuck on the L or it's 3 o'clock in the morning and you just can't sleep, you can always read Mike Novak's column at the end of the magazine.
They put him in the back for a reason, I think.
Inspire you to stop reading altogether. So pick up a copy of Chicagoland Gardening Magazine on newsstands all over Chicago, or it's a lot easier if you subscribe. Call 888-265-3600. That is 888-265-3600. Or go to ChicagolandGardening.com and get the only magazine that is dedicated to gardening in the greater Chicago metropolitan area. Where Heather's
looking for a housing investment that can pay big dividends? Remodel your kitchen or bathroom. You'll freshen up your home and add value to it, too.
Trust DR Services Unlimited, 847-998-1687 for all your remodeling needs. Kitchens, bathrooms, master suites, and more. Rated A-plus by the Better Business Bureau and recommended on Angie's List. DR is a proud member of NARI. DR provides exceptional quality at a fair price. Contact DR at 847-998-1687 or at RestoreTheNorthShore.com.
Okay, I have a little story to tell, and then I'm going to ask both Breanne and Ed to react and tell me what they think of this issue that I am about to raise. A week ago, I was volunteering at the county fair at the Garfield Park Conservatory, and I was doing the Ask a Master Gardener table, and I met a fellow master gardener who was answering garden questions with me, and we got to talking, as master gardeners will. And we sort of wandered around the county fair, and various master gardeners noticed that there were pony rides. And, of course, the only thing that a master gardener thinks when they see pony rides is pony manure. So I ended up driving my new friend home with this gigantic garbage bag full of fresh pony manure, and I mean fresh pony manure, fresh from the pony. The ponies were right there in the back seat of my car. And I will just tell you, folks, this is by no means the first time my car has had manure in it. But the plan was to add this manure to a home compost pile. So, Brianne, is that a good idea?
Well, not if you live in the city of Chicago. There's a composting ordinance, actually, that says that you shouldn't compost any kind of animal manure.
Ah, okay. Well, Ed, do you use manure up there at the Allen Centennial Gardens in Madison, Wisconsin?
We don't, but probably more because it's just not an easy thing for us to do, bringing it into the gardens. Certainly, manures add good value to organic matter. I'm not sure what Brianne said. I didn't hear her response.
She said it's illegal in the city of Chicago.
Well, that could be. But I guess what I try to get my students and public to do here is not always use the same material for organic matter that you're putting down every year. And a very good gardener from this area taught me that. Because each one of those sources of organic matter or compost is bringing something to the table, but it might also be missing something as well. So I tend to alternate between things like the mushroom compost, decomposed leaves, the manures, if they're properly composted, will bring fertility to the soils. But anytime we use manures, we don't use them in large quantities because many of the plants that we're doing don't take lots and lots of amount of that kind of fertility. But it certainly makes good organic matter. The big thing up here right now is llama manure. Apparently, llama manure brings something to the table. I don't even remember what they said. It's not readily available.
It would just be fun to be able to say you put llama manure on your garden.
Exactly. Sometimes gardening is just about having fun, isn't it?
It certainly is. Brianne?
One thing I just wanted to add, if people do decide to compost animal manure, is, again, keeping in mind that it has to heat up quite a bit. So usually for manures, they say around 145 degrees. And, again, so you're going to be creating a compost pile that's at least 3 by 3 by 3 feet or 4 by 4 by 4 feet and letting it age quite a bit. And then the other thing to keep in mind is making sure that your animal hasn't received any antibiotics recently. So, usually, maybe they'll get a course of penicillin for something, and then it'll come out. And if you put that into your compost bin, it can actually inhibit the bacterial activity that you want to start breaking things down.
So we have a question about whether you can use cat litter in a compost bin. Would you consider that to be a good idea?
I wouldn't do that here, again, just because I live in the city. But anything that was once living or inside of a living thing can be composted. But again, you'll have to get it up to the proper heat, temperature, and then also make sure that it's really, really well broken down.
So unless you have a really large compost pile and you consistently turn it and you get it really, really hot for a long time, it would probably be really, really risky to put your cat litter in the compost.
I think so. And I think especially thinking about whether the litter that you're using is something that will break down. If you're using clay pellets that have been treated with something to add freshness, that's probably not a good thing to put into your compost pile.
And the actual cat what's the word I can use on the radio?
Manure.
Manure. The cat manure itself, it can contain medications or it can contain pathogens So it's probably kind of a risky thing to do.
Right. And even eggs of, say, worms or, other things that the cat might be eating and, you know, causing problems with its life. They'll usually come out in the manure and will actually stay intact. So if you, you know, even if you compost that, maybe it doesn't get hot enough, you spread it on your lawn. Now you just introduced, some parasite eggs into your yard.
Okay. I want to take a minute here to talk about something completely different. I just want to let you know about something that's going on in Cook County. The Cook County Department of Public Health is developing a food policy, which is to say that they are looking at laws and regulations, and they're looking at the state of food delivery in the suburban areas of Cook County, mainly because Cook County mainly has sway in the suburban areas rather than the city of Chicago. But they have a survey going. They're asking for opinions about all of this. And obviously, this is a matter of concern to gardeners and people who are interested in urban agriculture. It has to do with where we grow our food, how our food gets to us, how we can get fresh local food, whether we can compost food waste, restaurant waste. It has to do with a lot of issues that are really of concern to gardeners. So I put the link to this survey on my blog at growinginchicago.com. We'll make sure that all the links to all of these things are on the MikeNovak.net website, which we're not actually in control of because Mike Novak isn't here. But we will get these links up on the website. And I do urge you to go to the Cook County Department of Public Health page or to my blog at growinginchicago.com. Find the link, take the survey, because that can really have an issue, an effect on how government in Cook County operates to encourage a safe, local, healthy food system. This is WCPT. This is Mike Novak show. Mike Novak's not here. I'm Beth Botts. And I'd like to thank my guest today, Breanne Heath from Growing Home, the Urban Agriculture Training Program for people who need to develop the skills to get jobs. I'd also like to thank Ed Lyon from the Allen Centennial Gardens at the University of Wisconsin. And I want to just mention one thing. Breanne will be teaching a workshop on composting in fall and winter Wednesday, October 5th at the Garfield Park Conservatory. $5 suggested donation, lots of good information. To register for that, go to garfieldconservatory.org. That's garfieldconservatory.org. And again, we will get that link on the Mike Novak website somehow. That would be mikenovak.net. So, Ed, any final words, briefly?
I guess not, other than we hope that all of your listening audience comes up and visits us at Madison and Allen Centennial Gardens.
Absolutely. And we will. The link to the Allen Centennial Gardens is on my blog and also on mikenovak.net. And, Heather, I think we did okay today.
I think we did great. I think you get more calls than Mike does, to be completely honest.
Well, we've been talking a lot of gardening today.
And I like that. We need to get back to the roots of the show, if you will, to play with words a little.
And I want to thank all the callers who called in today and the people who Twittered or tweeted or whatever you do.
I think they say tweet.
They tweet?
They tweeted.
The people who tweeted.
and on Facebook, you can find us. The Mike Novak Show does have a fan page on Facebook, so please, you know, like us there. And all that information, too, is on Mike's website, which is www.mikenowak.net. A lot of people want to swap the W with the V because it's pronounced with a V sound, but it's spelled with a W sound. So,
yes.
Just Mike's like, he's a complicated fellow. But we miss him. We hope he's having fun in his garden talk in St. Louis.
Yes. And again, this is Beth Botts. I've been hosting the Mike Novak Show. This morning, Mike will be back next week. carrying on in the way that only Mike can carry on.
Yes.
I can't quite carry on in the...
No, you're a lot more focused. He's very highly distractible, as Garden Design Magazine called him. But
Highly distractible?
Highly distractible was the quote they used for Mr. Novak.
Well, you know, yeah.
Yeah. Look, something shiny. Woo!
Woo! Well, but, you know, he's been doing radio for a long time.
Yes,
and he knows what radio...
And he makes it look so easy. We had a couple butterfly stumbles here and there, but I think we did a fine job.
I think we did a fine job. So this is the Mike Novak Show on WCPT, Chicago's Progressive Talk, 8:20 a.m. in Chicago. This is Chicago's only gardening and greening radio show. And
we say go green or go home.